It was actually, the media called it Clown Co. Yeah, so they're like, look at the clowns that are putting this together. There's no way this is ever gonna succeed.
This week on Builders, we talked to Beth Comstock, former vice chair and CMO of GE, one of the most powerful and respected women in business. Welcome to Builders, a podcast from BetaWorks Studios featuring the amazing people who build things, the makers and the doers, not just the talkers. The people who are helping shape this world and the next world we'll live in. My name is Layla Oweda, and I'll be your guide. Be sure to subscribe to Builders in iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. We release new episodes every Tuesday. All these episodes are recorded live at Studios, our New York City clubhouse for builders and anyone else interested in the startup ecosystem. Each week, they feature a new and diverse mix of people drawn from our community. Only at BetaWorks Studios will you find founders and the network around founders authentically chatting about subjects that really matter. If you want to know more about our club, just visit betaworks-studios.com anytime or contact me for a day pass. But listening to these podcasts is a pretty good reflection of life here. One week, we might be talking about how to design for blockchain or build experiences in the age of Instagram. And the following week, we're chatting with technology luminaries like Jaron Lanier on why we should probably all delete our social media accounts. This week, we feature the amazing Beth Comstock. She came into BetaWorks Studios to talk about how to manage innovation in large businesses and her new book, Imagine It Forward. That quote at the start about Clown Co., that was Hulu. Beth helped build Hulu while at NBC and then went on to run innovation and marketing before becoming vice chair at Megacorp GE. In this episode, you'll hear Beth talk about permission. Hear about why she used to actually keep printed permission slips on her desk to give her team. She'll also talk about how management as a control function is over, that good management is now all about having a vision and setting your team free to achieve that vision. So get comfortable for a masterclass on modern management. Beth is interviewed by Sharna Leibowitz from Business Insider. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Hi, everyone. So Beth, you and I have chatted once before, and you told me a little bit about the beginnings of your career, how you studied biology in college, and you initially wanted to be a journalist. Did you at that point ever imagine that your career would take you where it has?
No, I didn't. I mean, I studied biology, I wanted to be a science reporter, and here I am. In some ways, to what James was saying, though, for me, I did end up kind of having a career that's about storytelling. And putting the book together made me appreciate that. And I think for all of us, the value of story and kind of business, you're a strategy, you cover strategy. And I always like to say strategy is a story well told. And I think that's a good test of, do you have a good strategy? Is it a story? Does it hold together? So as I've looked back on my career, I think I've always been a storyteller. And now I'm even perhaps a bit more proud to say I'm a storyteller. And I think business needs to make room for story.
Sure. So it was more something you realized looking back that there was like a common thread going through.
Yeah, but I think, it's what drove us here to work with the teams at BetaWorks, because we wanted to unearth the GE stories. We wanted people to connect with the brand in different ways. It wasn't just about the logical outcomes. It wasn't just, you know, okay, we're going to make you more money. We're going to deliver XYZ product. It was, can you connect in a different way? We worked with startups because we wanted to unlock the entrepreneurial spirit in a big company that we knew existed. And it was about the stories of what does it take to start a company? What does it take to struggle to make that happen? So it was as much that connection, I think, that I find drove me and drove the teams I worked with as anything.
You know, one thing you just mentioned that I've always thought was really interesting is, I think you said unlocking this entrepreneurial spirit in a big company. And I feel like, you know, in my reporting, I hear this a lot, like, you know, be entrepreneurial in your career. And I'm never 100% sure what that means. Can you tell us what it means to you?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think it means something different for everybody. And I worry a little bit. You're so right, Sean. I mean, just to people throw it around all over the place. Like just saying it makes you one, right? Like, I'm an entrepreneur. Sure, right? Like, I'm just declaring it. And to me, entrepreneur is somebody who wants to do better. They see a better way, and they'll do anything to make it happen. And I feel like entrepreneurs are needed everywhere in the world. And they're not just here at BetaWorks. They're not just founders of companies. I think we'd all be a lot better off if entrepreneurs were driving our ambulances in the EMT. Our nurses felt they were entrepreneurial. Our teachers felt they were entrepreneurial. And that they would just fight whatever they had to make something better happen. So to me, that's what entrepreneurial is. And it's unfortunate for big companies that they created many roadblocks that forced many people, probably many of the people here, to go off and do their own thing. And it's good for you, it's good for the economy, it's good for entrepreneurism, but not so good for big companies because they've seemed to say, no, that's not welcomed here. Although hopefully that's changing.
Hopefully so.
Do you consider yourself an entrepreneur?
You know, I've been asked this question more times than one would think for a journalist, and I do. I think I'm sort of forging new ways of doing things, hopefully, if I'm doing my job right. Yeah. But yeah, I hope so.
And you're working in a news organization that was born from an entrepreneurial model.
Yes, it was. Yeah, so I think that's something that we really value, and hopefully a lot of companies value.
Yeah, I mean, at GE, we would go around saying, or I would say it, you know, hey, we're 120 year old startup. It was more of a rallying cry than it was the reality. I mean, maybe I'm the only one who believed it. But you know, you'd have to say, go back to, you're in a company that you can remember when it was founded. I'm on the board of Nike. Phil Knight still roams around. You can remember, and he certainly can remember when Nike was founded. As old as I am, I was not as old at GE when it started. But to be able to sort of remind people of like Thomas Edison, and every company has a founder's story. And it's really important that you don't lose sight of that as part of your story. And you as an entrepreneur, that you have your story, and you know that if that's part of your identity, what does that mean? How do you fight for better?
I'm curious, is that something, I'm sure you did a lot of hiring at GE, is that something you looked for in the people in the job candidates that came your way?
Over time, early on I wouldn't have. I think early on my career was probably one of more fear and looking to other people to, you know, what's the rule book and could I bend the rules or not? So I think that early on it was much more looking for the rules. And as I got more confident and more experienced, definitely more entrepreneurial. And I liked, especially toward the end, I gravitated to kind of figure it out roles, which I highly recommend that everyone should have at least one person on your team. Depends on how big your team is. If it's just you, maybe this is you, but who is a figure it out job. And I'll give you an example. I hired a woman who had come from doing financing of energy projects in Africa. And was like, okay, if she can make stuff happen in Africa, she clearly can figure stuff out. And ask her to come into the company and help us figure out a path for blockchain and Bitcoin. What does it mean to a big company? I'm kind of like, go figure it out. I don't know. Here's what success will look like. You'll find other people in the company who are thinking about it too. You'll put a working group together. You'll find resources and you'll come back with a strategy for how the company can do this. And she did it. And she found a lot of people. And I think we need more people like that in our company. So you give them just a little bit of direction. You're not really sure, but you like give them the carte blanche to figure it out. She was very entrepreneurial. So I do think I gravitated more toward that. And as we created a venture group, both when I was at NBC and at GE, created two different venture groups. And we were always looking to bring more serial entrepreneurs in. And it was a tough sell in the beginning because, like, why are you going to go work for a big company? But often, I think if you created the right spaces, they thrived in that environment because there was so much opportunity. And if you're entrepreneurial and somebody just says carte blanche, you go figure something out. One guy I'm thinking of in particular, he helped us create three new businesses that GE seeded. One was an inspection by drone business. Another was a kind of drone navigation business. And again, he found people in the established business units to come and work with him. And then it gave them encouragement. And they started to say, hey, I can behave that way. So I think those kind of roles have a multiplying effect that other people see, hey, I can do that too.
That reminds me of something else I've heard you say and seen you write about in your book. which is leaders acting without explicit permission from their bosses. It sounded a little bit like that entrepreneurial spirit. Yeah. So why do you think people are, well, two-part question, why do you think people are so afraid to act without that, you know, permission in bold letters, and how can we get better at doing that?
Yeah, I seriously thought of calling my book Permission Granted, because it's the underlying thesis of what I feel I learned in the course of my life in business and what I saw others dealing with is often we're waiting for somebody to tell us it's okay. And I saw this time and time again, big company and small, it's especially big companies, but it happens everywhere. This is what happens. Somebody comes in and they have a great idea and someone tells them no and you never hear from them again. Or alternately, somebody's like, they're like, I can never do that. I don't have enough money, enough time. My boss won't let me. My investors won't let me. My board won't let me. And actually, those might all have been valid things to have said. But really what they're, if you really dig out, they're saying, I'm afraid of trying it. So it's much easier to just say, you know, my investors will never go for that. Oh my God, my investors are horrible. They'll just never go for it. Because it takes a lot of permission granting of yourself to say, I'm going to give that a shot. Do I really need to ask my investors? Do I really need to ask the manager if this is okay? Do I know what's in the scope of what I can do? And so I just felt that was for myself. I saw time and again where gatekeepers, and by gatekeepers, I mean, these are the people who don't let you through the gate. They just, you know, say, no, you can't do that. And I would go, okay, I guess I can't do it. And then you'd go, well, wait a minute. I can do that. I didn't need to ask that permission. I even gravitated, it's kind of hokey, but I gravitated toward doing little permission slips with people I worked with. And it sounds hokey, and it is, okay? It really is kind of geeky. But the notion of, like you used to do in high school when you wanted to get out of gym or chemistry, I was too much of a goody-two-shoes fraidy cat, so I never did that in high school, so I needed to do it for myself in work. But I literally kept a stack on my desk, and people would say, I can't do it or whatever. I'd be like, okay, I got your back, but somehow I think that's not enough. Like, go fill this out. And it's little tiny things. I mean, it's just giving yourself permission to show up in a different way, to ask a question. It's not giving yourself permission to kind of bet the future of the whole company. But I think sometimes those small acts are what people need to do more of so that they can start to take on the bigger things.
So I want to go back to what you said a few minutes ago, which is that I think you said early on in your career you would kind of try to do something and then someone would say no and you just accept that no. Tell us about a time when that happened and you tried and just, you know, went back.
Yeah, well, I worked in media for a while before I ended up on the corporate side of GE. But one of the first times I was at NBC, I had a boss that he was I thought a jerk, and he just said no at every chance. And the team and we kind of got together. I finally got up my nerve. I did a kind of whole little report. I actually have it today. It was so powerful. It meant so much to me. I saved it. And I marched into his office and kind of gave him the report and said, we need to do better. And really all we were asking is, just let us have a shot at trying things. He kind of doled out all the answers. He told everybody what they could do. And he was like, no, basically you and the team are wrong. I'm kind of the boss. You have to do what I say. And I left. But what I realized is when I went to the next place, that there were other people like him and other bosses like him. And I've sort of seen that pattern in my career. So I think that recognition that there were ways I could have challenged it, there were certain things I could have done myself without asking for his okay, and the job would have been better. And, you know, you learn that over time.
I love that. I mean, as somebody who pitches ideas like on a daily basis and sometimes a lot gets turned down. I feel like I could use this, you know, go back to the drawing board and try again.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. You reminded me of another example. Again, I left and I ended up coming back to NBC, and I remember we pitched an idea for what was the NBC Experience Store. I thought it was just a brilliant idea, and it wasn't going to change NBC's fortunes at all, but it was, it was a marketing idea. We're going to have people walk around New York City with little bags, and I pitched it to my boss, and he said no. And the team and I were devastated, but we were so convinced this was the right thing to do. The CFO hated it. The ROI was horrible. We did our homework. We came back. Anyway, long story short, by the third time we pitched it, Bob looked at me and he said, "You know what? I tried so hard to say no. I wanted to say no. But you guys did a good job. I'm saying yes. And I'm saying yes because you made it so hard to say no. I think it's a good idea. It's not a great idea, but I know you guys are going to make it work." And so what I learned is he was testing us to see, did we have the passion? Did we have the stamina to go the distance? And also, like, the idea got better. We did better work. We had a little diorama. We started showing things. And we made it so real that he had to be part of it. But that wouldn't have happened had we not gotten sort of constructive feedback. But he was challenging us. So that was a big lesson for me.
You know, we started talking a little bit about management just now. One thing I've heard you say before is that traditional forms of management are all but dead. So what do you mean by that? And what does management, effective management, look like today?
Yeah, we were talking about this earlier. I really do believe management as a control function is over. And I worry about this. We were saying earlier, I worry about this because when we're not teaching it, and maybe you don't even teach it, it's more coaching your colleagues and you're getting yourself a coach, but it's perpetuated. Just generation after generation, we're told this is the way you manage yourself, your colleagues, whether you're managing a team, a project. This notion of just you control things. You don't. You don't control. We don't control much of anything. We barely control. I barely control myself, but you can speak for yourself. But we don't control much of anything. And so yet I think we're still in this model of I'm the boss. I manage this project. I'm telling you what to do. To me, it's much more your job as a, quote, manager is to have a vision. Where are we going? Why? Set the team free. Here's the vision. My job is to make sure you have the resources, the space, the coaching to get it done, the freedom to like test it along the way and know that you're not going to get it done perfectly, but you're going to get it done in a way that you think is meant to do. And here's our commitment. You're going to tell me when you need help. You're going to tell me when there's a problem. You're going to tell me what I don't want to know. So it's built a lot on feedback. And you're going to encourage your team to get stuff done. But instead, what we do is we try to micromanage things because we're afraid. We try to, you know, kind of think we can control people. And I think we just got it wrong. And I can tell you that based on a career of almost 30 years in business, I got that wrong a lot of the time.
You mean you got it wrong as a manager?
I got it wrong, and I got it wrong in thinking I controlled things. I got it wrong in thinking I controlled people. I mean, you know, I'm the manager. I said so. What a horrible answer. You don't say that to your kids. You don't certainly don't say that to your colleagues. The lack of openness to feedback, the lack of openness to ask for help. Those are things, whether you're managing a team of two, a project team of 50, or a company of 500,000, I think you have to have somewhat humility that you bring to the job that says, I don't know the answer. We're here together to figure it out. And I'm here to help you, but I'm not here to tell you what to do.
So related to that topic of figuring things out together, one thing you mentioned in the book, and I like this idea, is agitated inquiry.
Yeah, so lovely for conflict.
Yeah. So how do you encourage agitated inquiry at work, and do you think this is happening at most workplaces?
I hope it's happening at many good workplaces, but my experience is it's really hard to get to. And agitated inquiry to me is just beating ideas up and hopefully not each other to make sure they go the test of time. I share in the book, I devote a whole section to it, and I painfully share my experiences of where it didn't go well. And here's where it doesn't go where and where it falls apart in companies, because this idea of agitated inquiry is you're agitating for a better way and you're open up to like questioning. But what often happens in companies is when we get very territorial about an idea or someone's capability. So it's my team against your team. Or I've often been associated with teams where we're leading change. So if you're not careful, it's the cool kids against the people who don't want to change. And then it's like, they just don't get it, do they? The poor, uninformed souls. And the last thing you're going to do is ask them for any sort of input because they don't get it. Meanwhile, they have a point of view. They've been working. And so you set up this really weird dynamic of us against them. And so bad things happen. And I've shared some of those stories where you stop listening to one another. You make bad decisions because it's my team against your team, and how dare they? They're not allowed to make a point of view in that. So that what I've come to learn, and the better way forward, is to invite your critics in, to say, you know, and I'm not saying invite just all the Debbie and Donnie Downers of the world who are just negative people, but people with good critical points of view who have a different point of view, invite them in. Bring in outside sparks, people from the outside who have a different perspective, who potentially could disrupt what you're doing, bring you a reality check. Ask, tell me something I don't want to know. So you start to hear that critical feedback. And try to work your way through that. Anyway, I have a host of ideas, but I do think it has to be part of your process. If you're not inviting in criticism, inviting in critical thinking against what you're doing, inviting in just people who have difference in your team, you're never going to get to a better place. It's been my experience.
You know, one instance of bringing in an outsider that you write about in the book is has to do with the genesis of Hulu.
Yeah.
And I like that story because I think it's a good example of how something it seems unlikely, and through the right systems you make it more likely, if that makes any sense. So I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about why Hulu worked.
Yeah. So Hulu worked because we had done a lot of things that didn't work. And we finally knew how to at least get out of our own way. So I take you back 10 years ago to media and the emergence of digital media. This was at a time when YouTube was just starting, and if you were in the media world, I was at NBC, and you were in the media world, and at that time, the idea of cats playing the piano was like really funny. That's so cute. Ha ha ha. And then it was really scary because it was like, oh my gosh, we don't know how to make those videos of cats playing the piano. So people were really fearful, and the change was really threatening. And so I had been at NBC, sent to GE, came back, had made some change happen at GE. So they're like, hey, you like change, you help us figure this out. And we did some things that didn't work out. One of the first things we did was we acquired a big women's community called iVillage, and the company, we just destroyed it. Antibodies came out internally, and this happens in a lot of companies. You get acquired and the mothership destroys it. So we set about doing that. And we didn't get any closer to getting better at cats playing the piano. And at the same time, Fox and News Corp had a similar thing. You may recall they acquired MySpace, and they set about destroying it as well. And so we were all panicked at this point. YouTube got bought by Google, so the panic came out. And so we finally got together and said, we have to figure this out together. And because we had both failed, I think we were much more willing to do it. And we realized, as good as our teams were, we couldn't do this ourselves. So we went out and found an entrepreneur in Jason Kyler, who founded Hulu. I mean, we seeded it, but he founded it, he started it. And there were a couple of like rules or process checks we had to do. One, he had to be able to pull anything from the mothership that he wanted to succeed and reject anything that sucked, basically. We had created this beautiful video player at NBC. We spent a fortune on it. We're like, great, Jason, look, we have your video player all ready for you. And he's like, that thing stinks. It's horrible. It's a horrible user experience. I'm not using it. Now, if we had not had him and we hadn't set up this other structure, we would have forced him. We would have said, we had to write it off. Are you kidding? Do you know how much money we've spent? He could say no. He could and do what he needed to do. And so it worked because we gave him the freedom he needed. We gave him the resources to pull what he needed to be successful and say no to what didn't work. He had people like me and people like me at Fox who were able to champion that, to say internally, no, you can't kill him. No, we have to be able to fund what he's doing. And it was a lot of fighting. You know, the team at Bravo's going, well, why are you giving them money? I'm more successful. They haven't done anything yet. So it was that kind of mechanism. And out of that, seeing that you could actually seed something from kind of traditional roots with enough of the right mechanisms. Now, fast forward a decade later, Hulu's been reasonably successful. It's not Netflix, but it's up there. But you also think, like, what could the cable industry, the broadcast industry, have done if more of them kind of outsource what they were doing, Could Hulu have been even more of a viable competitor in Netflix? The story's still being written, but you know, I think it's also the struggle. Everybody wants to do it themselves. They fight the change. So I don't think the Hulu path has been easy either.
Yeah, I definitely see what you're saying, that there are a lot of very reasonable obstacles to pursuing a path like that. But ultimately, like in the long term, very good things can come out of it. So it's sort of like a tug of war between...
A total tug of war. I remember fighting with HR. They're like, well, what do you mean? We're going to pay these people in Hulu stock? Yeah. Yeah, but they could get really rich. Yeah. But they're taking a risk in doing this. Yeah, but they'll be paid differently than GE or News Corp. Yeah. So that, you know, right there, and it could kill something because you don't have the right payment and incentive structure. So somebody has to fight for that. It's not easy. That's why I think companies have a hard time doing this.
You know, we talked a lot about sort of the uncertainty surrounding your future as a big company. I want to talk about how you sort of approached uncertainty in your own career. How did you, I mean, you were at, when you count the years you were at GE and NBC, it was a really long time.
Yeah.
How did you know that that was the right place for you to be?
Well, I didn't always know that. You know, I'm ambitious, I'm competitive, I kind of jumped into a career. I talk in the book, I mean, my career started in a very, for me, unusual way. My career took off just as I became a mother, and I sort of went forth in a path as a divorce. I got a divorce and went forth as a single mother, and that really shaped my life in many ways and my career. So, but that created in me this real sense of needing to be responsible because I now was a mother and had to make money. And so I just had to work and I had to like make it work. And so that was really the driving force for me. I wanted to be a journalist, but pretty quickly I wasn't so good as one. I went behind the scenes. I was pretty good there and kind of created a path in communications that led to marketing and so on. But I didn't have a big plan. I didn't have like a 30-year plan that said I'm going to get to vice chair of GE and this is what I'm going to do. There were some things some opportunities I didn't take. I talk in the book about not accepting a job offer from Steve Jobs to go work for Apple. You know, in the annals of financial planning, that was probably not one of the smartest moves I ever made. If you look at the GE stock and the Apple stock, it probably was not so smart. But I didn't take that job because it wasn't what I didn't feel like it was a job I wanted to do. I had good reason. That being said, I did have regrets about it. So there were definitely times I had regrets. I guess if I were to sum it all up, my secret of what worked for me was to take assignments that people often didn't want. To take on roles. I went back to NBC at a time when the news division had been in disarray and everybody's like, that's the craziest job on earth, but I just knew I had to do that job. It was a gut check. It became my entrepreneurial awakening. I went to GE at a time when no one from media would ever think of doing that. People didn't want to leave NBC to go to GE. Why would you do that? I didn't take a Steve Jobs job because I just didn't feel like it was what I needed to do. So I've always tried to sort of do a gut check about what I wanted to do. And it kept me sort of taking on new assignments. GE was a huge platform for a curious person. I got to experience a lot of different industries, connect a lot of dots, be a real a student of innovation in a way I might not have in a less, you know, really the conglomerate model kind of fell out of favor along the way, but it was good for a curious, innovative person, to be honest.
Yeah, so it kind of seems like you had your hands in a lot of different projects and roles at GE and NBC, and you almost had starkly different jobs from the time when you started to when you ended your career there. And I think that's something, you know, I've been thinking about as I talk to people in my own reporting, is how to have different jobs in the same company or different careers at the same company.
Well, it's a couple of things. I'm a big believer, and especially now that I'm kind of out of a company, I wish I had thought more about this, but just professional fluidity. I'm much more, whatever I do next in business is going to be much more with this lens of professional fluidity, meaning I'm able to do different things at once. And I know that's why I stayed at GE as long as I did, because I was able to carve these different roles out. I was able to go from marketing to be head of innovation, because to me, marketing was about living in the market. And when you do that, you see change, you see innovation. It's not like I got an engraved invitation saying you must define marketing this way. It was there to be found. And so I've been a big believer in sort of job crafting, this notion of add responsibilities, take on things other people don't want to do that you want to do. I mean, you know, it has to be some have to be some return to the company. I'm not saying, you know, I have to go and do something crazy, but to push myself to take on assignments that other people didn't want or didn't see opportunity, and to use them as a way to build my skills, open up opportunity. And that's kind of what's kept me there, and what helped me build a career.
Well, I feel like I've just had a great career coaching session, so thank you. But I think we're going to turn it over to questions now.
So you talked a little bit about Hulu. I remember when that was announced, it was called like Project X or something. And I remember my reaction was thinking like, wow, two giant companies trying to do this. This is going to absolutely fucking fail. But obviously it didn't. It's one of the two biggest digital platforms in the world. So what do you think it was led that to be successful? And would you recommend that in terms of two giant corporations collaborating in that way again?
Yeah, it's funny you remember that. You thought that it was actually the media called it Clownco.
Clownco, that was it.
Yep. Yeah, so they're like, look at the clowns that are putting this together. There's no way this is ever going to succeed. And for good reason, right? The track record of all those clowns hadn't been so good. I think it's really hard for two companies to get together and do that. And I think the leadership teams of both companies were panicked, but had a real commitment. I mean, Peter Chernin on the News Corp side was very open to it. Jeff Zucker and our team was very open to doing that. We had a shared vision. So that's the first thing. Do you have a shared vision? Are you really willing to share the risk and the reward? And so you have to have the right kind of governance in place. And we both had to champion the change. So we had to be able to, when Jason would make the teams at Fox or NBC uncomfortable, we had to say, keep going, Jason, keep going. And we had to turn around to the team and go, like, he's okay, don't kill him, he's got to go forward. So you have to, people are willing to be in that uncomfortable space. Not all companies are willing to do that. Their investors go, what are you doing? You're wasting all this money. I don't see any return. For the first, I think it was like, might have been a year, but definitely the first 6 months, Hulu did not book any revenue. In fact, they didn't want to book revenue. And I was overseeing sales, and there was a lot of agitation. How many people can look at their investor and go, we're choosing not to have any revenue this year? So that's what you have to be able to do. So I think it was unusual, and I've been a part of those situations since then. Some worked and some didn't, and often they fell apart. The other thing that companies do, and if you're a startup and you're, you know, looking at being acquired or you're looking to go and partner with a company, big companies change out people a lot. So you might have a good vision and a good champion, and you get in the middle of it and they get changed out. So you have to be ready for a lot of adaptation if you're leading the charge as an entrepreneur.
Oh, I have this. Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Good. So I work in fintech for a 200-year-old startup called Citibank.
Yes.
And we are a division that perpetuates transformation and not change, because change happens to you, and transformation is a conscious choice.
I love the way you said that. That's really good.
Thank you. You can take it.
I am. I'm going to
move forward with it.
You're going to send me the little trademark?
I will. I have a white paper. I'll send it to you. So I work in product as well. So the reality is that with transformation comes reality, which is legal, governance, risk, compliance, et cetera. What has your experience been overall? We have probably similar situations where you try to innovate and you try to build something great and you get really excited about it and then you just get completely squashed.
Down. Yeah.
How have you kind of circumvented that overall nightmare that is my day-to-day?
Yeah. Well, you need some place where you can scream, like scream into your pillow.
I have a room. It's called the quiet room, but it's actually where I cry.
The crying room is good. I totally subscribe to that. So good. Check you have that, because it's frustrating as anything, right?
As fuck, honestly.
It is. A couple of things. I think that you usually get the, especially in regulated businesses like fintech, right? Well, we're regulated. That's an alibi. Really? okay, show me what the issue is. There are things you can try, and you, just as long as you know what the framework is. So I'd be very clear with legal. I've often found success bringing legal in, getting the right parts of legal and bringing them in early. My experience has been some of the most inventive people I've worked with in those situations when set free are from legal. I could point you to 3 or 4 people. In fact, I'm happy to give you the name of somebody who came out of legal and helped do some of this, and he could give your team some pointers. Same with HR. But the thing is, like, these folks are, they have a job to do. It's going back to, here's the problem we're trying to solve. That was also something I tried to a couple of ways of reframing it. Here's the problem we're trying to solve. I need your help. Okay, we know these are the restrictions. Now help us figure out, given that, how do we work within that? And I'd also reframe things as a bit of a hypothesis. Like, this is our hypothesis. And the last thing, and it's hard, I know, but often trying to invite some of those regulators in early, say we're creating this kind of test and learn space, have them on advisory boards, have them as some kind of toll gate, you know, that you're bringing them in early when it's less risky so that they're not totally wigged out by it. Those would have been the things I've seen helpful. Good luck. And maybe we should figure out a way to, maybe instead of co-working space, we can create corporate screaming rooms. Maybe that's our business idea out of tonight. Yeah, exactly. They could look really great, right?
Hi. My name's Kamika, and I just loved the book. There's
oh, thank you so much,
many,
Kamika. Thank
so
you.
Many good tidbits in it.
Thanks for reading it.
My question for you is, as a woman who very early on in your career, it seemed like you had access to Jack Welch and then Jeff and were involved with the succession and then, you know, making these big cases for not only yourself, but these roles and so on, and crafting a way to be the innovator that you are and the imagination running free. For people who, whether you're inside a corporation or you're external and you're an entrepreneur, what kind of advice, particularly for women, you know, these conversations to get access to those guys can be hard. And if you were struggling with maybe any confidence issues, et cetera, like you were describing, how do you get access and make your minutes matter and then know when to take the big risk, like when you did with bringing the French guy in with the velvet cape?
Yeah. Well, and I should preface it by saying, you know, some of the things you're talking about, I was pretty much late mid-career, right? I mean, some of that stuff didn't really happen until I hit 40, right? There was a lot of wandering around in the 20s and 30s of feeling, you know, lack of confidence. I'm never going to make it. I mean, I talk in the book about a job was open for 6 months that I didn't apply for that I thought had my name on it. Now, why would someone who had a brain do that, right? Because I lacked confidence. And what I found out is they didn't consider me for the job because they're like, you're a young mother. There's no way you could take on this job. So I didn't tell my story. So I, you know, partly was having to go through many of those experiences to do that. And out of that experience where I didn't put my name up for a job, they didn't consider me, I did get it because I finally raised it. That person ended up becoming a bit of a mentor to me and helped me get on the radar to someone like Jack Welch. But it was only when I kind of had to get out of my own way. So how did I do it? For me, it was just a series of small challenges, small steps when I would feel like I'm standing in my own way. I document in the book, I was 30 years old, working at CNN, Turner Broadcasting. I'd worked there a year. I worked with Ted Turner, the founder. He did not know my name. And so I talk about how I had to go up and introduce myself to him, and I did it in a very awkward moment. He was coming out of the men's room. It was horrible. But I'd given myself a challenge that I was going to do it. As awkward as it was, he never learned my name, but I did it. So those were the kind of things that I tried to share very painfully. Like, I was a mess. I am still a mess in many ways. I'm a mess in my head. I psych myself out of it. So a lot of it is just small, deliberate steps. I'm going to go make sure they know my name. I'm going to ask a question here. I'm going to show up. And one builds on the next. So, you know, that's hopefully what comes out a little bit, but that's what it takes. A few people I've seen in my career can just show up and go, hi, Jack Welch, I'm Beth, and I should work for you because I'm amazing. That was not me. I was shy, reserved, and I often had to have other people help me tell those stories. So what I try to say is, you know, be able to tell your story, be a champion for yourself, but challenge yourself in small, uncomfortable ways to get yourself out there. Thank you for that.
Okay, that was Beth Comstock and Sharna Leibowitz from Business Insider. It was a long one, but just so packed with great career advice that we wanted to cram it all in for you guys. A lot of the themes Beth talked about are in her new book, Imagine It Forward: Courage, Creativity, and the Power of Change, out now. You can follow Beth on Twitter at Beth Comstock. We are fascinated to see what she does next. If you'd like to spend some time with us, check out our membership details at betaworks-studios.com. As we grow the Builder community, we'll still be holding many public events, but the best stuff tends to happen during the day at BetaWorks Studios between the members, all sharing ideas and making stuff happen. If you'd like a day pass, just let me know. I can be found on Twitter at Layla Obeda. But also feel free to just click on the description box for other ways to reach me. Check back with us every Tuesday for new episodes. And if you leave us a review in iTunes, that would help so many more people find all of this great knowledge. Follow along with us on social media. We can be found on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at BuildersPod, hashtag BuildersPodcast for all things builders. If you click on the description box, it's all linked there. We look forward to hearing from you. And until next time, I'm Layla Ueda. Happy building from all of us at the BetaWorks Studios team.